Omaha Public Radio presents another lecture program from the College of St. Mary on Noon Forum. We'll hear a talk by Martha Hennessy, the granddaughter of Dorothy Day, the co-founder of the Catholic Worker Movement begun in 1933. Miss Hennessy will speak on the topic, The Catholic Worker Movement, Its Relevance Today. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Sunday evening, October 2, 2011, for broadcast at this time. The opinions expressed are those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of the College of St. Mary, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. Here now to introduce the speaker is Rebecca Hilton, Assistant to the President for Mission Integration at the College of St. Mary.
Martha Hennessy, mother and grandmother, lives with her husband on a small farm in Vermont. Martha is the seventh of nine grandchildren of Dorothy Day and co-founder, Dorothy Day, who was the co-founder of the Catholic Worker Movement. Martha works part-time as an occupational therapist and participates in resistance work against nuclear power and war, Guantanamo Bay prison camp, and the siege of Gaza. In her travels, she has given talks about her peace and justice works both in the United States and abroad, growing up with her grandmother's influence, and how the Catholic worker communities are continuing the works of mercy today. Martha is in Iowa to help celebrate the 35th anniversary of the Des Moines Catholic Worker Community, and we're most pleased to welcome her to CSM. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you all. It's great to be here. We have had a very busy last couple of days in Des Moines with the preparations for the 35th anniversary. And I just want to point out some literature. Please feel free to take both the newsletter of the Des Moines Worker, and also I brought a couple of issues of the New York Catholic Worker newspaper. Started in 1933, still a penny a copy. And I would encourage you to visit the Omaha Catholic Worker house here. I'm sorry, I don't know what the address is. But just 44th Street, 24th, Nicholas, north of Cummings. And they have been up and running for 5 years now. And I would like to start with a prayer. I think all great endeavors should start with a prayer. And this is a quote from Dorothy. She wrote this in 1951. A lot of her readings to me feel like prayer, so I thought I would share this one with you. As long as there is any resentment, bitterness, lack of love in my own heart, I am powerless. God must help me. I can safely leave whoever I am struggling with to their guardian angel, to God, to the Blessed Mother. I was hoping for more students, but tomorrow I think we'll have a chance to do a little bit more indoctrination. But I wanted to just give you a little bit of background of myself and my life and some personal stories of Dorothy, a little bit of the Catholic worker history, how it started, and some of the highlights and philosophies of the movement, and then give you a little bit of information about my involvement in the movement and my involvement in resistance component of the movement. And then we'd like to open it up to question and answer. I'm number seven of nine children. I was born in New York near the Catholic Worker Farm, Peter Marn Farm. He was the co-founder of the movement along with Dorothy Day. And my parents moved to Vermont in 1957. And I have grown up there. My husband and I built a house just across the field from where I grew up. So I've been there my entire life. My roots go deep in Vermont. And both of my children were born there. I'm trained as an occupational therapist. I spent a good 25 years working with kids in public schools, children with learning differences, and also working with the elderly in rehabilitation. I've been doing that very part-time. The more resistance work I do, the less professional work I'm able to do because my arrest record is catching up with me at this point in time. So it's a wonderful profession. I hear that it's offered here at the college, and I'm reluctant to give it up, but this other work seems to be consuming me at this point in time. I have a husband and three children and three grandchildren, one on the way, and we grow on our tiny little farm. Peter Marn was very much into the agrarian society. So my mother, I think, was a very good disciple of Peter Marn. And she did a lot of gardening and taught me a lot. So we grow probably 60% of the food that we eat on our little 8 acres. And my brother lives right next door. He raised his family nearby. I have lots of memories of Dorothy. I was 25 years old when she died. We would spend our summers at the Tivoli Farm in New York in the 60s and 70s. And we would visit her at St. Joseph's House, which is still operating in New York City, Lower Manhattan. We would visit her when I was a teenager, and she would come up to Vermont as frequently as she could. Her work was very pressing, and she started this movement with Peter Marn when my mother was 7 years old. And so she needed to get away. She needed to relax with her family. So she would come up as much as she could to be with her sister and also with my mother, her only child, in Vermont. I think my earliest memories of Dorothy, of Granny, we called her Granny, my earliest memories were sitting on her lap. She would visit us. She would tell stories. She was a great storyteller. She was just a regular granny. From a very young age, I was aware of her power and the reverence that people really held for her. But she did a very good job, and my mother also, Tamar, did a very good job of just keeping things regular and low-key. But my first memory of her was sitting on her lap when I was maybe 3 or 4 years old, and she was telling a story, and I had my ear against her chest, and this memory just sticks in my mind, this incredible sense of wonder and power and love coming from this person. And in my teenage years, we would spend plenty of time with her. She was always traveling and always giving us gifts, always bringing back wonderful things from foreign lands, from Africa and Australia and Europe. So she was always dropping little seeds, planting little seeds about God and beauty and love. And I was quite receptive to it as a very young child. And then as a teenager, I became more uncomfortable with her religiosity. And so I thank her for the time that she was able to spend with us and the books that she handed over to us, the things that she did to encourage and influence us in very gentle, very subtle ways. I have other funny stories. It was hard for her to be around 9 grandchildren in the Vermont culture. My brothers loved to hunt and fish, and so when she came up, sometimes we would put her in a room where there were a rack of guns, and to this day, I feel pretty badly about that. And she would ask us to put a blanket up over it. I don't know what my mother was thinking at the time. But so she had to put up with some crazy times with us being teenagers. When I was 14, my brother Eric was drafted. He was 20 years old. He went to Vietnam. He fought in Vietnam as a 20-year-old. And Dorothy did talk to him about whether he wanted to claim conscientious objector status, and he very clearly stated no, that he wanted to go through with this draft. And she was a person who greatly respected the primacy of conscience, so she did not try to influence him or condemn him or judge him at all in terms of his decision-making, but it was a significant blow. I understood war since a very young age. I was always hearing about suffering and war, but I never really could quite understand it until standing in the kitchen watching my brother go out the door wondering if I would ever see him again. So that became very real for me. And Dorothy talked a lot about having to witness war in her lifetime. And I'm feeling the same thing is occurring in my lifetime, you know, going from one war to the next and just having our hearts bleed about the level of violence and the level of suffering that continues to go on in the world. And seeing my brother's transformation just really made it very real for me, the effects of war. I'd like to share with you just a little bit about the Catholic worker philosophy. The movement started in 1933, and it started with a newspaper. Dorothy was trained as a journalist, and her father and her brothers were all newspaper people. And so she chose that profession, and her father was very upset and tried to discourage her from that because it was very much a man's world, and she was not to be deterred. She was going to write. She started writing as a child. And so she did pick the career of journalism. She studied it in college. She was a college dropout. She attended for 2 years at the University of Illinois, Urbana. And when she met Peter Marin, they started with the newspaper. And from there, things just evolved. She never claimed to be... She didn't even want to be called the co-founder of the Catholic Worker Movement. She laid everything at Peter Marin's feet in terms of his indoctrination and his laying out of the social program. But she started with writing, and they ended up with soup lines. This was in the height of the Depression. The Catholic Worker Movement was born out of crisis and born out of extremity. And there were people who were quite hungry, unemployed, striking sailors in Lower Manhattan during that time on the Bowery. And one of the men there had the idea of just offering a cup of coffee. And from there, it evolved into the soup line, the bread line. And from there, it evolved into providing beds. There were two women who visited at one point over the first couple of years of the movement who were in desperate need of a place to stay. And Dorothy had to turn them away. And she regretted that terribly because one of the women came back a few days later and Dorothy asked, "Where is your friend?" And she said she could bear it no longer and had thrown herself in front of a subway train. So the needs were pressing, the needs were extreme, and so they did their best to respond, starting with renting apartments. And then from there, being able to rent whole houses. And they were driven from pillar to post over the years. They had some wonderful houses. They had some terrible rat-infested houses. And sometimes they were set up with very beautiful arrangements, beautiful in terms of Catholic worker standards. And then the city would sometimes declare eminent domain and move them out. So the two houses now, Mary House on 3rd Street and St. Joseph's House on 1st Street, are still in operation. St. Joe's opened in 1965. And that it serves men. And Mary House opened in 1975. And that's where Granny spent the last 5 years of her life. And she died there at the house with my mother by her side. So I have come back to the worker just through a variety of different circumstances. And I have come back to the Catholic Church. But to get back to the philosophy, I would just like to read to you these 5 points. As I said earlier, the Catholic worker was born of crisis, but we also must remember beauty. Dorothy, in her writings, I would always advise everyone to go to the primary writings, Long Loneliness, Loaves and Fishes, but she always talked about finding beauty despite tragedy, and her definition of beauty was indeed another definition of God. But the first point, to reach the man in the street with the social teachings of the Catholic Church. The second point, to reach the people through the practice of the corporal and spiritual works of mercy at a personal sacrifice, which means voluntary poverty. Personalism and voluntary poverty are two key words of the movement. To build up a lay apostolate through roundtable discussions for the clarification of thought. And those were Peter's terms, roundtable discussions and clarification of thought. To found houses of hospitality for the practice of the works of mercy. And the fifth point, to found farming communes for the cure of unemployment, to solve the problem of the machine for the restoration of property, the resisting of the servile state, for the building up of the family, the original community, the first unit of society. And through my readings, I have come upon other various suggestions of lessons or tenets to go by within the Catholic worker movement, and I just will read these to you as well. Very important points. The term personalism, just to clarify that a little bit. For me, and there are lots of more academic, intellectual definitions, but for me, on a very personal level, we talk about acting in small ways in one's daily life, to take responsibility, to respect the free will of others, and our actions should always be directed toward the common good. It's very important for us to be true to ourselves, and we look at personalism, or taking personal responsibility, as an antidote to the state systems. Here's a very famous quote of Dorothy's: the solution to the long loneliness is found in community. Don't use money to make money. It is forbidden in the Old Testament very clearly, 3 times. Violence begets violence. Goodness begets goodness. We teach love by loving, by example. Our goals are lofty. We fail daily, and we are always given another chance. We're always redemptive. We're always redeemable. We must love the enemy and counter the fear of others. Our greatest strength or gift, and or gift, is in diversity. We can't always choose who we live with. And living in community and living in houses of hospitality, you learn that lesson very, very clearly. Be honest about the struggle. Never forget the power of faith. And we must be the suffering servant. I want to touch a little bit upon the Catholic social teachings, since Peter, delineates very early on the teachings of the Catholic Church, the social teachings of the Catholic Church, and the three that I think the Catholic worker has really modeled itself on within that, context of the principles of Catholic social teaching are, the first and foremost, human dignity. Belief in the inherent dignity of the human person. We find Christ in every person that comes before us. And if we can always keep that in mind, that every person is sacred and every person has the potential to be Christ, that is a foundation that we must never lose sight of in our system of dehumanization that occurs in our economic, political systems. The second point, the dignity of work, the rights of workers. Dorothy did spend a lot of her early journalistic years reporting on the condition of the worker in the United States, the intense struggle for justice, for decent working conditions, decent wages, a step up from serfdom. People have a right to economic initiative and private property, but these rights have limits. No one is allowed to amass excessive wealth when others lack the basic necessities of life. The third point, promotion of peace. Catholic teaching promotes peace as a positive, action-oriented concept. There is a close relationship in Catholic teaching between peace and justice. Peace is the fruit of justice and is dependent upon right order among human beings. Dorothy opposed every war that came before her. She felt that there was a direct connection between poverty and war, that running the houses of hospitality was an important first response to the needs that are directly in front of us. But if we could look at our economy in a different way, we could be meeting those human needs as opposed to the war machine. She did a lot of writing in the 1940s around this issue, and I just want to share this one quote. This was written in April of 1948, and it's pretty clear that things have not changed a whole lot in this time span. We have only accelerated the condition, the situation that we're in. This was from an article titled, "We Are Un-American, We Are Catholic." And she dealt on a daily basis with being dismissed as being unpatriotic and even communist. If we are to accept the materialistic and atheistic philosophy of the capitalist state, which holds sway in the United States, then there can be but little objection to this state of affairs. If our values are derived from the stock exchange, if we are to join in the psychopathic mania that has made war an end in itself, which has made it the norm of the American economy, if we are to be united against an ideology rather than for an ideology, then we are on the right track. She spoke with very strong words. During World War II, they lost at least half of the newspaper circulation. There were many people who went off to war who were in the houses of hospitality. The movement grew very quickly from the mid-1930s until World War II. I think perhaps there were maybe 30 houses around the country in some of the major cities. And with World War II, many people left to join the effort. And Dorothy was very good about accepting that. Once again, you know, the primacy of conscience is the first and foremost thing that we think of when we're dealing with each other on a personal level. And many of these people, you know, served in various capacities. A few of the Catholic workers would try and do the work that was not direct combat. And some did go to prison, and some were conscientious objectors. But the ones who came back, she always accepted them with open arms. There was never any judgment there. I mean, the war effort took over all of our society at that time, and she did not judge people on their decision-making. So many people did come back after serving. And during the Vietnam War, she very clearly supported those who refused to fight. And some of the first draft resistors, draft card burners, were associated with the Catholic worker movement in the 60s. A lot of contention, a time of great contention and difficulty. But she managed to keep her focus and managed to keep her faith and was able to articulate why she just did not believe that any war was ever just. I just want to tell you a little bit. We have over 180 communities around the country and around the world. I had a chance to visit the Catholic worker movement in England, growing very slowly, very small. The Catholic minority is so tiny in the UK, but they keep trying. And I spent 3 months there at the Catholic Worker Farm, and most of the people that we were taking care of were from the Middle East, refugees from Iran, Iraq, Tunisia, from Africa, the continent, Congo, and some women also from Eastern Europe, Albania, Poland. And to hear their stories was very, very heartbreaking. Some of the women had been trafficked, many of them trying to escape a war. And the men's house is in London, the women's house is outside of London, and I had a chance to visit both communities. And once again, there's a great diversity in these communities. There are atheists who work in these Catholic worker communities. There are people of Jewish extraction. There are people who are practicing Catholics. But there's really no criteria. Many students come through between undergrad and grad work. And I have been spending a part of my time at the New York Catholic Worker. We attended my grandmother's funeral in 1980. And I did not step into Mary House until 2004. And I left the Catholic Church in my early teens. I spent most of my adult life caught between Dorothy's conversion to Catholicism and Tamar's leaving the church with the dissolution of her marriage. My father left the family when I was 6 years old. And so it took me a very long time to figure out where I stood in this picture. And I went back to Mary House in 2004 and have since been re-engaging. But The way I came back into the Catholic worker movement was not through my faith, but through my participation in resistance work. And I had been arrested in 1979 when I was 24 years old. This was regarding nuclear power, the Seabrook nuclear power plant in New Hampshire. And five of us participated in this action, which consisted of leafleting public service office corporation, the people who were building the nuclear power plant. And we were given 9-month sentences. We only served 3, and that was a great awakening for me to be in prison and to realize, you know, most of the people in prison are people who struggle with learning disorders, addiction, mental illness, learning impairments. They're just not coping properly, and they end up in terrible situations. So that was my first experience in prison, and that was while Granny was still alive. And then I got involved with the Guantanamo Bay prison work, and there were a group of Catholic workers who actually went to Cuba and went to Guantanamo Bay prison in the fall of 2005. I got involved in 2007 and have since then been arrested just about every year around the January 11th anniversary. We are coming up on the 10th anniversary of the opening of the prison camp. And so we have been arrested at the Supreme Court, at the District Court, at the White House, in Congress. We tried to get arrested at the Department of Justice, but they finally caught on to the strategy changing in terms of how they're dealing with protesters. So I have been very much involved in that way. Today, we were just at the STRATCOM headquarters, and there were 3 elderly people who stepped over the line today, Sister Marian of the Franciscan Order, a friend of hers, and Gilbert, who is staying at the Des Moines Catholic Worker, who is a Vietnam vet himself, who has many combat-related health issues. I see the model of the Catholic Worker movement to consist of houses of hospitality, respecting the dignity of work of everyone, finding one's true vocation, and also resisting unjust laws. And the 3 of those principles need to be grounded in a foundation of prayer. And I always looked at Dorothy's life from a political stance, the social injustice. I couldn't come to grips with the gospel teachings, you know, that her whole foundation came from the Sermon on the Mount and her love of God. So I'm not sure what happened, but I started to go back to the church in 2004, 2005. One event that really galvanized me, I think. I felt this incredible helplessness. And when we're feeling helpless, we have nothing to do but to pray to God. But it was in 2004, hearing the stories about what was going on in Iraq. It was Dorothy's birthday, November 8th, and it was the same date as the invasion and destruction of the city of Fallujah. And there was something about that combination of what we were doing to this other country, these other peoples, on my grandmother's birthday that just moved me so much, so intensely, that I needed to turn to something. So I found my community. I found my community again in the Catholic Worker. And my husband comes from a Catholic background, but he has no interest in returning to the church, and he has no interest in becoming involved in the Catholic Worker movement. So we're in the process, we have been in the process of trying to find a balance with that, between my obligations to my family at home and my involvement with the Catholic Worker movement. And I experienced only too personally what happens when parents cannot stay together because of the intensity of one person's work, my grandparents, and the impact that it had on my mother. And so it was my priority to really make certain that my obligations to my family continued. And it's been hard. It's been very difficult. I do have two trials in the offing. November 1st, All Saints Day in Syracuse, New York. 37 of us were arrested at Hancock Air Base protesting the use of drones, robotic warfare. And the other trial date is January 3rd in Washington, D.C., and this is around the Guantanamo Bay issue. We were arrested in June at the House of Representatives trying to bring our concerns. We feel that we have exhausted every avenue of accountability. We've gone to our senators. I've gone to my Vermont senators. I've gone and congressperson. I've gone to the New York senators. And we've petitioned. We've done all of the things that citizens trying to bring their grievances to their government, and even having contacts and interactions with the Department of Justice, but really going nowhere with this issue of indefinite detention, suspension of habeas corpus rights, torture. And so we disrupted the House of Representatives, but they drowned our voices out very, very quickly. There were 14 of us in this case, and we stood up and gave statements about our concern about international laws being violated, the Geneva Conventions, all of those long-standing laws being violated with this creation of the prison camp. So those are the legal consequences of my participation in this work of visiting the imprisoned. I think the best way to visit the imprisoned is to go there and actually be with them. And I did spend this last Good Friday and Easter Sunday in Onondaga Justice Center in Syracuse, New York. And what I saw there was very painful, incredibly painful. We have 2.5 million people in prison here in the United States. And what I saw there were people of color, mostly people of color, women coming in, pregnant women crying for their own mothers, older women crying for their children. Very painful, very heartbreaking, very, very brutal system. So I consider that a very important ministry of standing up for the rule of law. I don't consider what we do as the breaking of laws. I consider us trying to hold accountable our government to the following of the rule of law. And I also had a trip to Afghanistan with a peace delegation in March. I've been very privileged to do a lot of traveling, Iran, Iraq, Egypt, Rafah border. I sat at Rafah border for 2 weeks in solidarity with Egyptian activists who were trying to bring the issue of the condition, the situation of the Palestinians. The Egyptians clearly understood that the future of the Palestinians and their own future were bound up together. We are all part of the mystical body of Christ, and the Muslims clearly understand the presence of God. I have to say that in my travels to the Middle East, I came closer to feeling the presence of God than I did in my own country. The most obvious being the call to prayer. Hearing those voices rising up to the sky in prayer is just an astounding thing. But we did take a trip to Afghanistan, and we met with these young people, 14 to 21-year-old boys. They're called the Afghan Youth Peace Volunteers. And they are committed to finding a nonviolent solution to the situation in Afghanistan. And they are like a tiny, tiny little flame in a huge hurricane. But they are committed, and they understand that if they walk this way, that they will probably walk to their deaths, you know, attempting to bring this idea of nonviolence in such an intense conflict zone. But we heard stories. We saw refugee camps. We saw the U.S. military bases. We saw the road out to Bagram. Bagram is much bigger than Guantanamo. It was just a tiny little outback village, and the Soviet Union built a base and a prison there. So our own country has now expanded on that military base, and it's not clear how many prisoners are being kept there. Red Cross is not allowed in. Red Cross has said that the situation in Afghanistan is untenable. 30 years of intense violence and now facing a famine. So when I came back from Afghanistan in March, it was very clear to me that going to the air base where some of these drones are being sent out, we heard from families where members were dismembered or killed from drone strikes. And going to meet the other, going to meet the enemy, I think that is something that Dorothy and Tamar instilled in me very clearly, that it's so easy to dehumanize the other until you go see them face to face. And so we met with many Afghan people, and they're struggling with corruption, never mind the U.S. invasion and occupation within their own country, the ethnic strife and the corruption. But to just be with them, to go there and to witness their suffering, and to just be a voice of compassion and listening, giving no advice. They don't need any advice. They need the space to regain their country themselves. And they know only too well what it's like to live under the Taliban, and they have absolutely no interest in returning to that. But we were not there to advise anyone. We were there to just simply be with them and to share with them. And it was a very intense experience. I think I can end it there. I'm sorry to get so deeply into the resistance component of it, but it really has been first and foremost on my mind. I would say one thing about my return to the church. I clearly lay it at the feet of Dorothy and the Blessed Mother. Revisiting and returning to recitation of the rosary was definitely something that drew me back into the church. And it's been a very sharp learning curve for me to return to those roots of Catholicism within the context of an institution that is human and that is imperfect. To quote Dorothy herself, of course the church is corrupt. And with her own conversion, she had many misgivings. And I too feel I spent my 20s and 30s and 40s with that contention of the church, and you know, I felt like I had thrown out the baby with the bathwater. I lost sight of Jesus because of my anger and disillusionment with the church. So I really had to come to some kind of accountability to that. But living in community has certainly helped me tremendously to be comfortable within the church again. Sometimes I hear homilies that are just horrifying in terms of war and other issues, but it's so important to not contribute to the voice of contention. We are just surrounded by so much contention and violence that the best thing that we can do is be a witness to a peaceful voice and finding concordances. That was the other point that Dorothy made. Finding concordances is absolutely imperative for us today. So thank you.
I think we have time for some questions, if anybody has anything they'd like to ask Martha.
Do you get any kind of a sympathetic ear from Senator Bernie Sanders, your friend from Vermont?
We have three representatives in Vermont. Bernie's wonderful. He's a socialist. And we also have Patrick Leahy and Peter Welch, who are both Catholics. And yes, Bernie is sympathetic. And yes, he wants to know when I'm in jail and why. And And I have visited him in his office in my orange jumpsuit. And he wasn't there the day that I went there. I have to give him that. But he's very receptive. But he's new in the Senate. He was in Congress for many years. And now he's been in the Senate maybe his second or third year. And his heart is in the right place. His words are right. But as far as being part of a body, the Senate, it just seems quite impossible. And Patrick Leahy himself, I met with him with five other people in person. And, you know, he just throws up his hands and says, I'm doing what I can. The way that our Congress is functioning now is very different than 10 years ago, 20 years ago. And the contention is huge. And in order for them to get together enough of a caucus to move anything forward, it's very difficult. So I actually have been quite disillusioned with the political process. I think we need to put our bodies where we want the change to occur. And I think what's happening right now, Occupy Wall Street and all of the other protests, the latest New York Times that I saw before leaving New York last week, the front page was nothing but global unrest, global protests, not one word about what's going on domestically. And there is a lot going on here now. And I think that my senators and congressperson, you know, support that voice, to bring that voice forward. But I don't hold a lot of hope in that process. I think that process, our democratic process, is pretty much impotent and corrupted. I mean, in Afghanistan, they were telling us, warlords run every ministry of the government except one, the Ministry of Agriculture. And I couldn't help but, any problem that was discussed there, I couldn't help but think of the counterpart of that problem in my own country. And the big money, the corporate interests, some of our representatives are fighting very hard, but I think the corruption is so intense that, I mean, our president currently, he's following the same policies and even stepping up the same policies. So I don't know what the difference is in terms of the leadership. I think that there's a system and there is a process that's in place that the only thing to stop it is mass public protest, shutting down the economy. Rather than letting the Wall Street guys shut down the economy, we should, as consumers, shut down the economy. So I don't know if that answers your question.
Do you have any childhood memories of Peter Marin?
No, he died in 49 and I was born in 55. But my sister did, my mother and my sister. Peter just was nonstop talker. He would get on his soapbox and point his finger, and Tamar said he just loved to talk. And he talked about round table discussions, but I think people had to work really hard to get their word in edgewise. But, you know, Dorothy describes him in her writings as, you know, being very eccentric, being rather difficult to understand due to his French accent, but also the concepts that he was trying to put forth. I mean, she did not have a lot of Catholic teaching with her conversion. So he essentially did a lot of teaching for her. But he was very modest. Sometimes he would do speaking engagements and he would come to the door and they would say something to, they wouldn't recognize him as the guest speaker and would send him out back to go get a crust of bread or something. And he would never say a word and he would be very humble. And he wore the same clothes year after year. And towards the end of his life, my mother talked a lot about the last year of his life. He had a stroke, and so he lost that power of speech, which meant so much to him. And so she and my father spent a lot of time with him in his last year of his life, where it was very hard to understand his speech at that point. But Dorothy lays everything at Peter's feet in terms of this movement happening. And there are more books coming out on him, focusing on him. I think that, you know, he got short shrift in terms of understanding his contribution to the movement. But there is a book called Apostle to the World that Dorothy started to write, never finished, and someone else, Francis Silkus, I think is the author's name, put something together about Peter's life. He was one of 20 children, a French peasant.
I was wondering, you talk about corruption in other countries and in this one. I wonder if you have any opinion on, I've heard anywhere between 20 and 25% of the money that the Pentagon gets, they cannot account for to Congress, and that's been true for decades. Where do you think 20 to 25% of the money the Pentagon gets is actually going? Are there generals getting rich from this? Are they handing this money out to warlords and they just don't want to tell anybody? Or what's going on with that much money?
I have no idea. It's the black budget. Very few people know. I would just surmise that, you know, the corruption, the CIA is very active in what's going on now, and they're not accountable to anyone. And 25%, when we look at our entire budget, nearly 50% of our actual budget is going towards war. We have a war economy. I think there's no denying that. Our economy relies on war. And I think that corruption, it's very easy to fall into, I suppose the money goes into yachts and villas, and we can't even begin to understand what goes on. Just standing at Offutt Air Force Base, the Stratcom Center, and I've stood at several bases like that, but that's one of the key bases right here. The feeling that I get is just this infinite, endless flow of money to support this war machine. And so many of us are bought into it. So many of us are reliant on the war economy. And, you know, to dedicate $600 or $800 billion a year to this, I think we need to take responsibility ourselves in terms of our own standard of living. We have such a privileged standard of living. When I met the Afghan peace youth volunteers, to see how they live, to see how people at Rafah border live, to see how people in Egypt live, it gives you a very clear sense of what incredible privilege we have. We're consuming a huge percentage of the Earth's resources to sustain our standard of living. And that's where the term voluntary poverty comes in. You know, if we can get outraged over 25% of the budget being unaccounted for, but we're accountable. We are complicit in this with our standard of living. It's not to say that I'm advocating that we not educate our children. And I mean, I worked very hard as a occupational therapist. I paid my war taxes. I mean, I've contributed to this budget. I mean, another important component of the Catholic worker movement is war tax resistance. And I have to live with my compromises. Each of us has to. But as far as holding the Pentagon accountable, you know, I think that's the first and foremost thing that what we're seeing with Occupy Wall Street is bring the war dollars home. The needs here are so intense. And Afghanistan, the graveyard of empires, we can see where we are being so depleted. I spent most of my working years working in the public school system, and the defunding of education. Vermont is trying to get a universal health care system in place, and hopefully they can set an example for the other states. But to see the defunding of education, of housing, our roads. I mean, our standard of living is slipping. I think it's very clear with our infrastructure and with our ability to cope with natural disasters. But we have certainly reached a point of moral decay. I mean, just to observe the way we were unwilling and unable to help Haiti in such an intense, horrific situation. And yet there's billions unaccounted for. So, I don't know, there are very hard times ahead.
This is kind of a curiosity question. Mm-hmm. Did you get to know your grandfather, and was he involved at all with his grandchildren?
No. I come from a family of missing fathers. My grandfather Foster is an enigma to me. I think that he understood. I think he understood that there was something driving Dorothy, and he loved her enough to not stand in the way of that. I met him when I was an adult, but I didn't know. He was very shy. He's very much like my mother, quite shy, quite reserved. I know that my oldest brother, visited him and spent a little bit of time with him, but there was just something there in his heartbreak of not having been able to be a father and a husband that kept him away from the grandkids. And Dorothy would admonish him. There is a book out, All the Way to Heaven, the collective selected letters of Dorothy's. And the first part of the book is her letters to him, which I had a chance to read before they were published. My grandfather died in, I think it was 1984, a few years after Dorothy. And to read these letters is absolutely heartbreaking. I mean, she is begging him to, you know, be a husband, be a father. And I think, you know, for some men, it's easier to just separate oneself. So neither Tamar nor I saw much of him. Yeah. But I would recommend the two latest books, her journals and her letters. Very personal, very detailed. You really gain a sense of her daily life through those readings, published by Marquette University.
In 1996, a film was released, a very little-known film called Entertaining Angels, which was a biopic of Dorothy Day with Moira Kelly playing Dorothy and Martin Sheen playing Peter. I was wondering how familiar you were with the film, and were you involved at all in its production?
Not at all involved in the production. Saw the film when it first came out. I guess I should revisit it. Martin Sheen was rather embarrassed about the whole project. A dramatization, the Hollywood rendition of the story. But there's another documentary that came out in 2005. Claudia Larson put together a documentary, Don't Call Me a Saint. And that's very good. I would highly recommend that. I can't bear to watch it since my mother died. She died in 2008. And to hear her voice is difficult. But that's a very good story depicting her life. And more the faith component of it, and not so much her arrests or her involvement with the socio-political aspects, but very good. Entertaining Angels, I don't know. I worked in the Visiting Nurses Alliance as an occupational therapist, and I worked with a great social worker. And one day she said to me, "Did you see that film about your grandmother, Avenging Angels?" And I thought, that's a good title. Or she got confused about the title of the pic, but it wasn't that well done, is the general consensus. But it's hard to please those Catholic workers. They're very critical of others telling her story. So can't please everyone.
Well, Martha, thank you so much for being here. Thank you for all of you for attending this evening. Martha will also be here tomorrow at noon in the auditorium, so if you know someone else that you would like to invite or have come, please encourage them. Thank you all for coming. Thank you, Martha. Thank you.
You've been listening to a lecture program from the College of St. Mary on Noon Forum. We've heard a talk by Martha Hennessy, the granddaughter of Dorothy Day, the co-founder of the Catholic Worker Movement, begun in 1933. Miss Hennessy spoke on the topic, The Catholic Worker Movement, Its Relevance Today. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Sunday evening, October 2, 2011, for broadcast at this time. Special thanks to Glenn Sisk, former Director of Marketing and Public Relations at the College of St. Mary, for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. Complete Noon Forum listings, as well as an archive of previous broadcasts, are available on our website, kios.org. Now, this is your producer and host, Bob Cote, thanking you for listening.